A very good evening and a welcome to everybody. My name's David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities and Director of the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this latest in the series of inaugural lectures hosted by the HRI. Inaugural lectures are, of course, intended to offer opportunities for recently appointed professors in the Arts and Humanities Division to spell out their vision for the development of their subject, thereby bringing the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience both within and beyond the university. I say beyond because in the usual way, and with our lecturer's kind permission, a recording of this evening's lecture will be made available on the HRI's website as soon as practically possible after this evening. Also, in the usual way, we won't be subjecting the lecturer to any kind of formal questioning afterwards, but there will be a chance for informal conversation over a glass of wine immediately after the lecture. Normally there is water and fruit juice as well, but that doesn't seem to have been delivered this evening. I hope that won't cause too much consternation in the assembled company. Anyway, our lecturer this evening is Professor Bob Hale of the Department of Philosophy. That department itself, of course, is an extremely successful and high-profile one. For example, in last year's National Student Survey, the Sheffield Philosophy Department received the highest score of any UK philosophy department for overall student satisfaction. While in the Philosophical Gourmet report, it's ranked fourth equal in the UK by UK assessors and sixth equal in the UK by all assessors. And in the Gourmet report's most recent assessment, the department was listed apparently in a greater number of specialist areas than it had been previously, and was especially highly ranked for philosophy of language and pragmatism. I'm sure it wasn't mere pragmatism that led this outstanding department to reinforce its already populous and robust professorial ranks by the appointment of Bob Hale in January 2006. Bob came to Sheffield from Glasgow, where he was Professor of Metaphysical Philosophy. Before that, he'd been lecturer, then reader in Logic and Metaphysics at St Andrews, and lecturer in Philosophy in Lancaster. Among his many distinctions are a British Academy Research Readership, held from 1997 to 1999, and Fellowship of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, to which he was elected in 2000. In 2002-03, he was president of the Aristotelian Society. Such are the very bare outlines of a distinguished career. Now, in fact, this is the first time that I've found myself introducing an inaugural lecturer whom I've not previously met. I met Bob for the first time at a meeting earlier this afternoon. And therefore, I have no personal information of the kind that might be used for some innocent bantering in the interests of pre-lecture embarrassment. The first recourse in the search for such information is always, of course, the lecturer's head of department. But if the juiciest titbit that your head of department can come up with is that his kids think you look like Father Christmas, then you're obviously pretty scandal or even gossip-proof. So, after that line of inquiry had drawn barely more than a blank, my next recourse was, naturally enough, good old Google. This, as one might expect, produced an encouragingly high number of hits. One of the pages near the top of the hit list offers the following summary characterisation, which did come as something of a surprise in the light of the reported remarks of Bob Stern's children. Hail Bob is feminine, chic and distinctive. On closer inspection, this description turned out to come from the website of a women's clothing company in the USA. So perhaps I would glean more from another Bob Hale website, one that promised, inter alia, biographical data, salary data and miscellaneous items of interest. Bob Hale, I read on this site, was 21 years old when he broke into the big league. But no, this Bob Hale turns out to be a Major League Baseball player, born on Tuesday the 7th of November 1933 in Sarasota, Florida, and whose career took him to the Baltimore Orioles, the Cleveland Indians, and finally the New York Yankees, none of them in any sense in the same league as the University of Sheffield. The only common ground would appear to be that, like the University of Sheffield, these teams did not make public the salary details of their star players. Nor do we find much more in the way of biographical data, alas, in Bob's Wikipedia entry. Even under birth we read N.A., which I take... which I do take to mean not available rather than not applicable. But this disconcertingly described stub entry does steer us back onto academic terrain, listing Bob's main interest as philosophy of mathematics, philosophy of language and modality, and his notable ideas as Neo-Fragian philosophy of mathematics. So finally, we're getting somewhere. And I should point out at this stage that I was told earlier this afternoon, about half an hour ago, by a research student in the philosophy department, that Other people in that department think that Bob looks like a philosopher rather than Father Christmas. Now, at this point, always a poor swimmer outside the shallows of my own subject, I must head well out of my depth with the help of the Philosophy Department website, which I'm glad to say came right at the top of the Google hit list, well optimised. This tells us that much of Bob's work has been in the philosophy of mathematics. During a long collaboration with Crispin Wright, he's defended a Neo-Fragian position, a Platonist version of logicism inspired by Frege. His research as British Academy reader was mainly in this area, and one of the products of that readership was the first published Neo-Fragian construction of the real numbers, entitled The Reason's Proper Study, Essays Towards a Neo-Fragian Philosophy of Mathematics, which was written jointly with Crispin Wright and published by Oxford University Press in 2001. He's also done a good deal of work on the epistemology and metaphysics of modality, the theory of necessity and possibility and related notions, and some work in parts of the philosophy of reference and meaning, and, according to the website, a little in metaethics, where his efforts have been mainly devoted to sabotaging Simon Blackburn's various attempts to overcome the notorious Frege-Geech problem besetting expressivist and projectivist accounts of moral talk and thought. Bob's published work includes, in addition to the book I've already mentioned, the 1987 volume Abstract Objects, and the 1997 Blackwell Companion to the Philosophy of Language, co-edited with Crispin Wright. It also includes a daunting number of articles in journals and edited collections, with intriguing and challenging titles such as Is Platonism Epistemologically Bankrupt?, On Some Arguments for the Necessity of Necessity, and Can Arboreal Knotwork Help Blackburn Out of Frege's Abyss? Certainly the extensive publication list of this big-hitting academic is of considerably more interest than the career stats of his baseballing namesake from Florida. Though perhaps in these days of increasing pressure to produce metrics to demonstrate the quality and impact of our academic research, the difference between the websites of the two Bob Hales will somewhat diminish over the coming years. But this is not the time to contemplate such a dismal prospect. This, our Bob Hales current research, is divided between two main areas of interest: mathematics and modality, and the connections between them. That focus is reflected in the title of this evening's lecture, and it's now my very great pleasure to invite Bob Hale to step up to the plate and speak to us on the problem of mathematical objects, a modest and sober Platonism. Bob, welcome.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you. That's the end of the jokes. Probably. I should say, first of all, that it's really an honour to be invited to give a lecture like this, and I'm very grateful for it. And I hope it'll also be a pleasure, even for me. I saw it as an occasion on which to, as it were, explain myself. I mean, what am I doing here? What do I do for my living? So I'm not exactly going to lay out a large-scale research program so much as to try and say a little bit about my interest in the philosophy of mathematics, or at least part of it. The part of it that I think is more accessible to an audience of people from different disciplines rather than specialists. So this is calculated to frustrate any mathematicians here who won't hear about anything exciting to do with technical problems in the philosophy of maths. And it will probably frustrate the philosophers as well, because I won't go as far into it as they would like. Maybe there's somebody in the middle of all who will be not too frustrated by it. I might push this a little bit further away. It sort of feels as though it's going to kind of hit me in the eye like a baseball or something. I haven't got any means of defence. I have a sort of script, and I might try and roughly stick to it in the interests of time, as it were. I don't usually do that. I usually just burble on. In a more or less structured way, but so the talk I'm going to give has five bits, including some opening remarks, which I'll come to in a minute. The second bit of it is what I call Platonism and the access problem. And I'll say here, since he's here, that I thought of this title partly because of David Bell. In some sense, my predecessor, or in some sense, I'm his replacement, I think. I mean, I think the only real sense in which I'm his replacement is that I occupy the office he once occupied. I couldn't replace him in any other sense. But in, I think it was 1979, David took part in a symposium at the joint session of the Mind Association and the Aristotelian Society under the title of Access and Inference. And it was one of the early and important discussions of this, I think, quite deep problem in the philosophy of mathematics. After that, I'm going to discuss what I regard as obstacles to a solution to the problem. Then I'll start trying to describe how I think the problem is best approached. So that's a section on singular thought and general concepts. And I'll finally end by saying something about what I think modest and sober Platonism is and what its advantages are. So, some important and difficult problems in the philosophy of mathematics are really inseparable from quite advanced mathematical results, and so they can't fully be understood or discussed without quite a bit of background. But it seems to me that this is not true of at least one of the most fundamental problems, which can be posed very easily by asking two very short questions. What is mathematics about, and how do we know about it? Of course, the simplicity of these questions doesn't mean that they admit of easy and simple answers. And indeed, even if some fairly simple answers are right, explaining why they're right, and especially if my experience is anything to go by, persuading others, or indeed even oneself, that they're right, is pretty unlikely to be easy or simple. Just as well, it keeps me off the streets. The most fundamental mathematical theories, from the philosophical point of view at least, are elementary number theory, analysis, or the theory of real numbers, and set theory. Number theory is the general theory, including elementary arithmetic, of counting, or natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Analysis is the theory of functions of real numbers, the rational numbers, or fractions, together with the irrational numbers, like root 2, root 3, pi, and so on, which can't be expressed as ratios of integers or whole numbers. And finally, set theory is a very general and powerful theory whose axioms collectively assert the existence of an enormous universe of sets of ever-increasing infinite size. So if we take these theories at face value, part of the answer to my first question, what is mathematics about, seems quite straightforward. Mathematics is about numbers of various kinds, their properties and relations, functions from numbers to numbers, sets of numbers, and so on. The question is whether we can take this answer at face value. And to see why one might think twice about that, we need to think about what's involved in doing so. Talk of numbers and sets is, on the face of it, talk of objects of certain kinds. That is, things that can be identical with or distinct from one another, things that have various properties and which bear various relations to one another. In this respect, numbers seem just like any other objects, like you and me, the bits of furniture around us, more recondite objects like cells and molecules and atoms and so on. We can count the prime numbers less than 100, just as we can count, say, the people in the room. more people than primes, I think, at a glance. But in another respect, there seems to be a very big and rather disturbing difference. To put it rather bluntly, we can't trip over the number 17 or bump into the set of even numbers. Indeed, it doesn't seem that we can have any sort of physical interaction with a set, even if its members are things with which we could interact. More generally, numbers and sets, if there are such things, would seem to be abstract objects, objects which, roughly speaking, have no position in space or time. And being outside space or time, they're out of the causal swim, too. Only what's in space and time can causally interact with other things. So, at this point, epistemological alarm bells and lights start flashing and ringing and flashing. And of course, no one seriously supposes that all our knowledge directly results from causal interaction with the things or stuff we know about. Maybe that's how it is with some pretty basic bits of knowledge gained by perceptual contact with our surroundings. But much, most surely, of what we can collectively know or take ourselves to know is known by a quite complex and sophisticated process involving a lot of inference and theorising. And it concerns matters that lie beyond the reach of ordinary perception, or even perception extended by telescopes and microscopes and more advanced technologies. That's right enough, but that reminder that most of our knowledge, or reasonable belief, is only very indirectly causally linked with its objects, doesn't suffice, at least in my case, to drown out the alarm bells. One obvious point is that in cases where we don't have any very direct causal interaction with the objects that we know about, there's at least, say in the case of historical or geographical facts or fairly low level and roughly true generalizations about observable things, including elementary bits of mechanics and optics, for instance. I mean, in these cases, there's a reasonably clear indirect connection. There are contemporary memoirs, there are letters, there are reports, there are observations and experimental results that are relevant to the empirical general laws that we think we know or roughly know. What we know is at least indirectly anchored in suitable interactions with the world. Of course, there are all the more exotic propositions of fundamental and advanced theories where what we know is even more indirectly linked to physical interactions between us and our surroundings. But even if philosophers of science don't quite agree about the details, no one seriously doubts that there's an intelligible epistemological story to be told, which fits with a sort of broadly naturalistic view of the world. How, if it can mathematical knowledge fit into this picture? If it really does concern abstract objects that are sealed off in, as it were, splendid causal isolation, doesn't it seem rather that this simple answer to the first question blocks any satisfactory answer to the second? Well, that's the problem, as it were. This view of mathematics, that it's about a lot of abstract entities of one kind or another, is usually known as Platonism. On the good side, Platonism gives an agreeably simple and natural account of what maths is about. It gives the account that maths suggests in its very language, takes it at face value. But it threatens to obstruct any satisfactory explanation of mathematical knowledge or reasonable mathematical belief. It runs into what we could call the access problem. A lot of recent philosophy of mathematics, I suppose I mean philosophy of mathematics in the last 30 years, can be seen as responding in some very different ways to this problem. Many philosophers, pessimistic about the prospects for a positive solution, have abandoned a face value construal of mathematical language and tried to reinterpret it so as to dispel the appearance of reference to numbers and other abstract objects. Some, even more radically, have claimed that we can accept standard mathematics, taken at face value, as a useful fiction, and so leave ourselves free to deny that it's true, and so not really known at all. The titles of some influential and much discussed books in the last few decades are quite revealing here. One of them is called Science Without Numbers, an American philosopher called Hartree Field. Another, Mathematics Without Numbers, another American philosopher, Jeffrey Hellman. Well, I'm not going to take time now to explain my disagreements with these and other, as we might say, defeatist views. I'd certainly agree that if we couldn't solve the access problem, we would have to accept that mathematical propositions can't be regarded as true when taken at face value, and we would therefore need to find some other way of justifying our acceptance of them. I don't think it's an option to reject very much mathematics. But I'm not going to speculate about what that might be, because I'm not convinced that the access problem is intractable. Instead, what I want to do is try to explain how I think the problem is best approached. I think there's a couple of particular sources of epistemological or more generally philosophical perplexity about the abstract, which, as it were, aggravate the difficulty of seeing how knowledge about abstract objects can be explained in conformity with, roughly speaking, naturalistic constraints. So I'll identify two things here. The first is that we tend to operate with a wholly negative conception of abstract objects, as I put it earlier, as outside space and time. That's obviously metaphorical, as well as negative. I mean, there literally isn't anywhere outside space and time. But the metaphor isn't particularly damaging so long as we remind ourselves that that's all it is. So the literal content is really that it makes no sense to ask where a number is or when it came into existence or how long it will last. It's the negative aspect that it seems to me impedes constructive thought. If we focus on what abstract objects aren't, then, and we don't think about what they are, then we can scarcely expect anything but intellectual paralysis when we try to consider how we might know about them. So that's one factor. The second factor is the idea that, I think this is not often explicitly acknowledged, but I think the idea underpins or runs through quite a lot of discussion. The idea that knowledge of truths about objects of any kind has to involve some sort of contact with those objects. The idea goes back a long way, but thinking about this, I remembered Russell's famous principle, which he expresses in that lovely little book, The Problems of Philosophy, in these words. He says that every proposition that which we can understand must be composed wholly of constituents with which we are acquainted. I'm not going to go into what Russell might have meant by acquaintance there. That's a big issue. If contact is understood literally as requiring some kind of physical connection, then that immediately rules out knowledge of abstract objects, obviously. But it's not clear why we should accept such a requirement. if contact is understood much more broadly and metaphorically, so that possession of any sort of identifying knowledge of an object would suffice for content, then I think the idea reduces near enough to a truism. One can hardly be credited with knowledge of truths about certain objects unless one knows which objects are in question. So that need not be harmful unless it's coupled with the further idea that this kind of contact is presupposed by and must be already in place, as it were, before any knowledge of truths can be got. So once we become locked into thinking about the access problem in this straitjacket, then I think we can hardly avoid a further thought that it's not just a problem about how we can know anything about abstract objects, but it goes actually much deeper. How can we even so much as think about them at all? Indeed, you can see that that's really the more fundamental problem. The knowledge problem wouldn't even get off the ground unless we could think about abstract objects. So if we can't solve the reference problem, or the problem of a thought about the abstract, then it's finished. So it's the reference problem, as I call it, that needs to be tackled first. And one might hope that at least part of a solution to the knowledge problem would drop out of a solution to the reference problem. So I want to say something now about thought about objects in general, thought about particular objects. And what I say here will necessarily be very broad brush stroke and need quite a lot of qualification that I won't have time to put in. But roughly speaking, it seems to me that thought and talk about particular objects, what's sometimes called singular thought, requires, on the part of the thinkers who have those thoughts, general concepts of the kinds of things or objects on which their thoughts are directed. Of course, that does need qualification. In thought about concrete objects, or at least in thought about those concrete objects on which we can focus perceptual attention and to which we can perhaps point, so things that aren't too small or too big or too far away or too close to be pointed at. In these cases, we may have no very clear idea at all of what kind of object it is that we're thinking about, and we may possess no reasonably specific concept under which the object of our thought falls. I'm swimming along, looking at the bottom, with my head under water, and I wonder, what's that small black thing on the bottom? Is it a nose clip, or a beetle or something? No idea. Just some small black thing. That's as close as I can get. However, it seems clear enough that with thought about, however it may be with thought about the concrete, abstract singular thought can't proceed without some general concepts of the kinds of things, of the kinds that the objects of abstract thought instantiate. So to make progress with the leading question, how thought or talk about can focus on particular abstract objects, we need to see how we might form or grasp general concepts of kinds of abstract object. Now, it seems to me there's an obvious contrast here with general concepts of many kinds of concrete objects. At least in simple and arguably basic cases, concept acquisition proceeds there via what philosophers usually call ostension. That is, the trainee's perceptual attention is guided by demonstrative gestures to instances or non-instances of the concept that we're trying to get across. We point to something and say, that's an apple. And we point to something else and say, that's not an apple, it's a banana. And so on. Obviously, there's a great deal to be said about the detailed working of this process and its limitations. But without going into that, I think it's reasonably evident that that can't be how we come by general concepts of abstract objects. Of course, it isn't either how we come by lots of concepts of other types of concrete object. Ostension, even when backed by supplementary verbal explanation, isn't the route by which we get such concepts as maiden aunt, or geologist, or parliamentary constituency, or budget deficit. You know, there's Gordon pointing to the figures, yes, but you know, that doesn't help, does it? And obviously this is, as it were, true in spades of more theoretical concepts like chromosome and electron, gravitational force, superstring. In some cases, some of these cases, we can use other words already understood to specify the conditions that things have to meet in order to fall under the target concept. In others, concept formation is not really easily separable from some rather difficult to describe process of becoming immersed in a theory. You don't really understand what electrons are until you know quite a bit of physics. Even more so with superstring, for instance. I'm not even sure that I... Well, I better stop there. It's too difficult. And again, you know, there's a great deal to discuss here that I must put on one side. What I think we can safely assume is that any account of how we form or acquire general concepts of abstract objects is going to draw heavily on the possibility of verbal explanation, if only because it makes little or no sense to attribute concepts of the abstract to languageless creatures. But while the models to which I've just been alluding might be helpful in explaining how some abstract kind concepts could be introduced on the basis of other abstract kind concepts, neither seems at all well placed to explain how such concepts might get into our repertoire in the first place. How, we may wonder, can the conditions for something to be an abstract object of a certain kind, such as a number or a set, how can those conditions be specified in terms which make reference exclusively to the concrete? Well, I think it helps to see a way forward, to notice that many of our terms for abstract objects, the terms with which we at least appear to refer to particular such objects, are complex terms, and more specifically, that they're what one might call functional terms. So here are some simple examples, taken not quite at random. One might talk about the shape of that vase, or the square of the number 17, or the number of Scarlatti's keyboard sonatas, or the set of natural numbers. These are all complex modes of designating particular things, or at least trying to. Well, here I'm contrasting complex terms with simple proper names. Of course, it's true that we do have syntactically simple names for abstract objects, or at least what appear to be names for abstract objects. Names like pi, and I can't pronounce it, but the name that you can write for the set that has no members, the null set, is certainly not significantly structured. It's for, well, one standard one is a sort of circle with a line through it. Somebody can perhaps tell me what that's called. I don't know its name, that symbol, but... anyway, that's another example. But the point is that these are really just abbreviations for complex terms. pi is an abbreviation for the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, and whatever that symbol is just an abbreviation for the complex term, the set, which has no members. We know that there can only be one. I think this is no accident. By calling such terms functional, I mean that they're aimed at picking out their object via its relation to something else. Where a relation F is functional in the usual sense, that is, it's the case that F of X and Y and F of X and Z, if and only if Y is identical with Z. So a function is essentially a relation that's many one. And in that case, we can properly say that the value of the function F for the argument or input X is the object Y. Now, that suggests that abstract objects pretty generally might be thought of as determined by an operation or function on things of some other kind. And perhaps ultimately, a function on concrete objects and their properties. If that's right, then if we could see how we come to understand this kind of function or operation, we could explain how we form general abstract concepts such as shape or number or set. Well, I shall call an expression standing for an operation of this kind an abstraction operator. So examples of abstraction operators are expressions like the shape of, the number of, the set of, and so on. So once we've seen how we could define such abstraction operators, we could easily go on to explain corresponding abstract general terms. A shape just is, well, to be a shape is just to be the shape of something. To be a number is just to be the number of so-and-sos for some suitable term so-and-so. The number of people in the room, say. So a fundamental part of the access problem reduces, or near enough reduces, to that of explaining how we could define abstraction operators. If we could do that, we could explain both how we can engage in singular thought about at least some abstract objects, and also how we can form corresponding general concepts. But how are we going to do that? The task is to see how to define expressions standing for a certain kind of function. Functions, as I remarked, are relations of a special kind. And the usual way to define functions, in fact, goes through a suitable underlying relation, which we presume to be already understood. So, to give you a simple example, one functional expression is the expression the father of. So, applying that to a name gives you a term that stands for, or if all goes well, stands for a particular object. We can think of the father of as standing for a function from animals to animals. It takes you from one animal to another, and the other being related to the first animal in a certain way. We can define it in terms of the underlying relation that is expressed by the words X begat Y, or more lengthily, X is male and X is a parent of Y. We observe that each animal has one and only one male parent. Now we can just define the father of by saying that X is the father of Y, just in case X is the male parent of Y. Now, that's how we very often explain functional terms, not just with an informal example like that one, but also in the mathematics. I mean, if you think about how you might explain, say, the functional expression, the square of, you notice that if you take the relation, say, x times y equals z, and then you restrict that by taking x and y to be the same, then you get the square of function. There's always a unique number that is x times itself. So here we're defining the square of function, the square function, in terms of an underlying relation involving multiplication, product. The trouble is that if we proceed in this way in trying to define abstraction operators, we run into a snag. We can illustrate this by taking the number operator, the number of. If we were to try to define the number operator in this way, we would be trying to define it on the basis of some underlying relation that we might express in something like this way. X numbers the f's. So instances of that form might be 4 numbers the moons of Jupiter. Twelve numbers the apostles, and so on. Now, in order to justify a definition of that kind, one would, of course, first need to prove that if x numbers the f's and y numbers the f's, then x is identical with y, so that we really are dealing with a functional relation. But there's a far more serious problem from the present point of view, which is this. The variable f here in my expression, x numbers the f's, varies over general kinds of objects, horses, apostles, numbers, chairs, tables, and so on, just as we would expect. But what does the variable x range over? Well, it has to be understood as ranging over numbers, because it's numbers that number things. That means that we need to already know what numbers are in order to understand the definition of number, of the number operator, in terms of the underlying relation, x numbers the f's. So there's no hope, that's obviously hopelessly circular, and there's no hope of our being able to form the concept of number by this root. Right. Well, I come finally to modest and sober Platonism. It took a stroke of brilliance, I would say genius, to see a way around this impasse. The author of the stroke of brilliance was Gottlob Frege, often regarded, as many people here know, as the founder of modern logic and certainly one of the two or three thinkers responsible for it. In his first book on the foundations of mathematics, a book called The Foundations of Arithmetic, Frege considers the possibility of defining the number operator in this way. He says that we could define it, or at least he entertains the possibility of defining it, by means of laying down the following, that the number of f's is identical with the number of g's, if and only if the f's and the g's correspond one-to-one to each other. So the number of horses is the same as the number of cows if there's a one-to-one correspondence between the horses and the cows. The number of people in the room is the same as the number of chairs in the room if there's a one-to-one correspondence between the people and the chairs, perhaps resulting from each person sitting on a chair and no chair not having a person sitting on it. I can see that the numbers are different. Right. Well, the impasse breaking idea is that we can define the number operator by fixing the conditions which are necessary and sufficient for the operation or function for which it is to stand to have the same output or value for given inputs or arguments. And that we can do this by using the fact that, there will be just as many Fs as there are Gs, their numbers will be the same, just in case there's a one-to-one correspondence or mapping between them. How does that solve or help to solve the access problem? Well, it's crucial to see, first of all, that what it is for the Fs and Gs to correspond one-to-one, although it uses the numerical word one, can be explained, contrary to first appearances, without any use of number words. And in fact, Frege showed how it can be done in purely logical terms. I'll explain over a glass of wine to anyone who doubts it. But I won't do it now. Well, that means that without any prior understanding of number talk or other mathematical vocabulary, you could come, via Frege's definition, to understand the number operator, and so to understand at least one standard way of referring to individual numbers. And that as good as explains how singular thought about numbers is possible. So we have at least the beginning of a solution to the first part, the fundamental part of the access problem, what I call the reference problem. Further, the definition correlates the truth values, truth or falsehood, of a basic class of statements about number with that of statements about something else that we already understand, the relation of one-to-one correspondence, something we can indeed explain non-numerically. So, it equips you, I mean, you know how to establish the truth value, truth or falsehood, of statements about one-to-one correspondence, at least in reasonably simple cases. So you're now equipped to determine the truth values of certain basic statements about number, statements of numerical identity. So we have at least a step towards a solution of the other part of the access problem, the knowledge problem. Actually, Frege's principle takes us a lot further, as I'll explain very briefly in a moment. I want to just pause to note that in order to avail oneself of this solution, one must reject the assumption that I highlighted earlier, what might be called the prior contact assumption. That is, the assumption that in order to be able to understand or come to know a proposition, one must be already independently able to identify the objects that the proposition is about. Instead, one must accept that the ability to understand at least some terms for objects, singular terms as they're called in trade, or the ability to identify the reference of those terms in thought, that ability or these abilities are coeval with our ability to understand certain complete sentences or to grasp the thoughts that they express. We don't first come to identify the objects and then are in position to grasp the thoughts. The two things are inseparable. That's something that Frege, I think, clearly saw. And it's the point, or at least part of the point, of his famous context principle, which he at least once expresses in words that mean something like this, that only in the context of a proposition do words have any meaning. Well, these are the first steps towards what I'm calling a modest and sober Platonism. A Platonism that, as it were, allows you to think of mathematics as about abstract objects whilst taking some of the pain out of doing so. Well, as some people here know, the going gets pretty tough from here on. There are some serious and hard objections that have to be tackled. The modest and sober Platonists, two of us, I suppose, have been and still are doing their level best to deal with these objections. One of the main problems, I mean, there are a lot of problems, but one of the main problems, as with any serious theory in philosophy, there are always big problems. One of the main problems is to explain how one can justifiably rely on what's usually called second-order logic. This is for people who don't know about logic. Roughly speaking, what is called first-order logic is logic in which we restrict the kind of natural quantifier words of English, like everything and something and nothing, to generalizations about objects. Whereas in second-order logic, we have quantifiers in which we by means of which we can generalize about properties of objects. And then in third-order logic, quantifiers in which we can generalize about properties of objects, and so on, up, and also relations. Now, it's certainly a fact that one can't do anything much in the way of getting arithmetic going by the route that I prefer without relying upon at least second-order logic, and maybe we need more than second-order logic. And one of the main problems, to come back to the thought I started to express a minute ago, one of the main problems, I think, and one of the problems that I'm actively working on, is to explain how we can justifiably rely on such a logic, given its apparently very substantial existential commitments. I suppose the orthodox view about this is that second-order logic, if it's tolerable at all, and some people think it isn't, so much the worse for even higher-order logics, if tolerable at all, second- and higher-order logic really just amounts to set theory in disguise. So one's just sort of cheating, as it were, by using part of the target to solve the problem. Well, obviously it's crucial that I can resist that kind of view, and I think that that can be done, but I can't go into that now. I will go into it over a glass of wine. Instead, let me end by giving, as it were, a snapshot, especially for those of you who are unfamiliar with this territory, of where we might go from here, if we can indeed go anywhere at all. There are two main areas in which one might hope to make, or even to have made, some progress with mathematics and with abstract objects more generally. Let me say a little about the second first. The definition of the number operator that I described earlier, the definition of the number operator by means of the equivalence, the number of f's is the number of g's, if and only if the f's and g's correspond one to one. That's now generally known as Hume's principle. Because Frege, rather generously, probably over generously, credited David Hume with the key idea. This was a generosity that wasn't characteristic of Frege's later writing, I might say. Anyway, this principle, the definition of the number operator, is an example of what is now generally called an abstraction principle. More generally, an abstraction principle introduces, on the left-hand side, as it were, an abstraction operator by giving, on the right-hand side, necessary and sufficient conditions for the truth of identity statements joining terms formed by means of that operator. So one could Right, so you've got on the left-hand side with Hume's principle, you've got the terms, the number of Fs, the number of Gs, and the right-hand side tells you what needs to be true in order for the left-hand side to be true. It says, well, for the statement of identity to be true, there has to be a one-to-one correspondence between the Fs and the Gs. Another famous example used by Frege is that of a possible definition of at least one notion of direction of a straight line, where you might say that the direction of line A is identical to the direction of line B, just so long as lines A and B are parallel. So the way these conditions on the right-hand side are specified, this is what marks off abstraction principles as a class, is by means of what's called an equivalence relation on things of some suitable kind. Perhaps on objects, as in the case of the direction equivalence, perhaps on properties, as in the case of Hume's principle, with the number operator. Now, that suggests a general strategy for explaining talk and thought about abstract objects that might avoid getting stuck on the access problem. Wherever we can use an abstraction principle to define a suitable abstraction operator, we can explain how we can talk and think about objects of the given kind. How widely, this is a genuine open question in my view, how widely can we do this? In some cases, it's reasonably clear what the abstraction operation should operate on. The difficulty is to see how to frame a suitable equivalence relation on things of the relevant kind. A case that illustrates this is that of musical and literary works. On my view anyway, these are abstract objects. For example, if we took, say, Haydn's 33rd Piano Sonata, that was distinct from published scores, manuscripts, live performances, recordings, and the like. That is not a concrete object at all. In this case, the relevant equivalence relation will surely be a relation on concrete objects of those kinds, on scores or performances or recordings or whatever. Similarly, with plays or novels or poems. Philosophers often in this context make use of a distinction between types and tokens. So the idea is that the work of art is a type, and one wants to explain what types are in terms of an equivalence relation on tokens of this approach. Well, it's jolly hard to see what the relation is going to be in these cases. That is, when two performances or two scores are of the same piece of music, how much and in what ways can they vary? Another sort of difficult, potentially recalcitrant class of cases, I think, is that of geometrical objects, points and lines and so on. And yet another troublesome class of cases is that of quantities or magnitudes. We talk about lengths, masses, volumes, and so on. And on one plausible view, it seems to me that these are abstract objects of a certain kind, but it's particularly difficult to arrive at a suitable equivalence relation on the things that have length or mass or volume. Those are areas which might show the sort of points at which this approach runs into the ground, although I'm not giving up yet. Let me just turn finally to say something, or rather briefly, about mathematics. I think the position can be summarised here in something like this way. If we can use Hume's principle to define the number operator, it doesn't just give us, as it were, access to numbers. Combined with a suitable background logic, we can actually prove the infinity of the natural numbers, and more generally, we can prove the usual axioms for arithmetic. the so-called Dedekind piano axioms. So arithmetic, insofar as it can be given a foundation at all, is given one on this approach. Can we go further? Well, yes, we can. As David Shepherd was very kind enough to mention, I showed some years ago how we can define the real numbers using another abstraction principle. And I showed, using a yet further abstraction principle, how we could prove the existence of a complete ordered field of real numbers. So that as good as gives us at least basic analysis. Not long after I did that, another philosopher of mathematics, a good friend of mine, Stuart Shapiro, showed how to do it in a quicker and easier way, a way which simply mirrors the standard construction in set theory. I prefer my method on philosophical grounds, but Shapiro's would do the necessary technical work, so I have no quarrel with it on that score. Can we go further? Well, pretty certainly we can go some way further. The interesting question is how much further. We think that we can develop an abstractionist version of set theory. It maybe won't be quite the usual set theory, but it will be something decently close to it in strength. At this point, I would need to get a bit technical to explain how that goes on, so I think that's probably not a good thing for me to do. And anyway, as one conveniently says, when one hasn't got the results, the work is in progress. Well, that's it. I think I'll stop there and hope that I've given you at least a rough idea of what I do.